Collectively, they're known as the two Michaels, and quite frankly, most of the time that people talk about them, they don't mention their last names. I'm speaking, of course, about Michael Spavor, an entrepreneur, Michael Kovrig, peace advocate, both arrested in China about 4 years ago for allegations of spying. Will we ever know the full story of these two gentlemen? Have we heard it yet? They haven't said a lot since returning from their exile, their imprisonment in China just over about a year ago. They appeared recently at Joe Biden's dinner and his address to Parliament. But other than that, we haven't heard much. Two men who've written extensively about this are Mike Blanchfield and Fenn Osler Hampson. And before we get to them, I just want to remind you that you can subscribe to Full Comment Podcast. Hello, I'm Brian Lilly, your host. You can subscribe to it anywhere that you listen to podcasts, Stitcher, Apple, Google, Spotify, what have you. Make sure you hit subscribe. Make sure you leave a comment, a like, share it on social media, and help get the word out. Now, the story of the two Michaels fascinated me while they were in jail because I can't imagine what it was like for them and the conditions they were living in. I can't imagine how difficult it was for Canadian officials trying to deal with this very international and complex story. And that's what we want to talk to Blanchfield and Fenn Osler Hampson about. Mike Blanchfield, longtime journalist with the Canadian Press, now with Blue Sky Strategy. Fenn Osler Hampson is a professor at Carleton University, president of the World Refugee and Migration Council. They both join us from Ottawa. Gentlemen, good to speak to you both again.
Good afternoon, Brian.
Want to ask you, do you think that based on what you've written, based on what we've seen in the media over the last several years, will we ever know the full story of why they in particular were arrested and what happened to them?
Well, I'll weigh in on that a little bit, if I may. I mean, we probably will learn more in the coming years because I think Michael Kovrig, while he was in prison, and it's talked about in our book as well, was really eager to re-engage with the world and get out and get his freedom, obviously. He is a pretty accomplished writer as a government employee at Foreign Affairs and then as an analyst for the International Crisis Group, which is the organization he was working with when he was abducted. And I think we're going to probably hear from him at some point on his experience on what really happened, because he's really the only one who can tell it. As for Michael Spavor, he went to ground very early on in the week after his imprisonment. Global Affairs Canada put out a statement, from a short one or two line statement on behalf of the family, with a photo of Mr. Spavor with a dog, saying basically, just wants some private time and wants to reengage with his life. And frankly, who can blame him? So, I mean, we, in our book, Fenn and I think we set the stage on how it happened, why it happened. And we literally stopped writing the moment they got out of prison and returned to Canada. But I agree that there's probably other chapters to be written, but I think they'll be written by the people who were in the middle of this, the two Michaels themselves, perhaps one of them, maybe both of them.
Michael, let me stay with you. You and I, when we were both on Parliament Hill, I can't count how many family members were imprisoned in various countries, and you would constantly have family still in Canada, coming to the media, coming to the government, saying, you've got to tell their story, you've got to talk about them, here's what's going on. We didn't have that with the two Michaels. In fact, it was very difficult to get their family members to speak. How much access did you have to family members in writing the book, either of you?
The Spavor family kept a very low profile. It was deliberate. As I've told other people, if it was my brother in prison like this, I probably would do the same thing. I wouldn't be talking to people like you or me either. But Kovrig's wife at the time, Vina Najibullah, decided to go public about a year or so after he was in prison. She went on the CBC. She made herself available for interviews. I interviewed her a number of times over the course of covering the story and including a lot of that material in the book. She made herself available to the International Crisis Group that did a podcast and interviewed her in depth on her experiences. And so she created a very strong narrative portrait of what Michael Kovrig was enduring. So we learned a bit about that. We know that both men had quite a reading list of material, but it seems that from what we understand, I think Fennell probably agrees. I think the two families kind of turned to Vina as their spokesperson, their champion, to get this to kind of keep this story alive. And as their imprisonment grew, it just seemed like it was going to take a lot more to keep this in sort of the public eye. And that was sort of the reasons why we decided to write the book in the first place, was to remind people in case they just started lingering in prison without a lot of attention.
Fenn, let me ask you, were these two Canadians, I mean, we know the backstory, that they were arrested in retaliation for Canada detaining Men Wazoo, but was this just a case of unfortunate circumstances for two Canadians in a very complex geopolitical game of war?
Brian, I would say that both Spavor and Kovrig were clearly in the line sights of Chinese intelligence and security officials. Spavor, because of the work he had done previously and continued to do in North Korea, based from his base in China. And Michael Kovrig, being a former diplomat working for a very high profile human rights organization, the International Crisis Group. He was there on secondment. And so their activities, and I think it's fair to say, you know, Michael Kovrig is high visibility. You know, they were being watched. The really interesting question, Brian, is why did the Chinese go after two Canadians when they could have easily arrested American businessmen or business persons in China? There are lots of Americans in China, because the warrant for Meng was issued in a New York court by the U.S. Department of Justice. And I think, the interesting question there is, you know, why didn't they go after an American? Why did they go after, you know, two Canadians? And I think,
I think
it's because they were worried if they went after two Americans, this would be escalating the situation. And so remember when the announcement of the arrest came, it came just as the G20 summit was taking place in Buenos Aires. Donald Trump had just had a great dinner with the president of China, Xi Jinping. Prime Minister Trudeau was also at that dinner. There was a lot of talk at the dinner table about turning the page on the trade dispute that the United States had with China. And then this arrest takes place, and it's done while Xi Jinping is on the world stage. And this was seen as a personal affront to Xi Jinping, given the high-profile nature of Meng Wanzhou. And so that turned it into, what we would call a global embarrassment for the Chinese. And so the officials around Xi Jinping, their boss was probably pretty upset about this. And they would have said, well, we got to do something about it. Let's go after the Canadians. They, after all, and this is a Chinese term of derision they use against Canada, we're the lapdogs. And so that's how this happened. And the fact that Kovrig was a former he was actually on secondment, so he was still technically in the employment of the Canadian government as a diplomat. They decided to go after these two guys.
Was that a mistake on our part that they were allowed to be arrested, or Meng Wanzhou was allowed to be arrested while this high-profile international dinners going on, and they're talking about improving relations?
Well, the timing, you know, the timing was really bad from that standpoint, obviously. I think it was a confluence of circumstances. I mean, Meng Wanzhou could have been, they were watching her movements, where she was traveling. The arrest warrant had been delivered in August, 2018. So, you know, the actual arrest took place on the 1st of December. So, you know, for those 2 months, they were seeing where she was going. She was traveling around the world. And, you know, to be honest, I think the American authorities felt more confident that the Canadians would actually honor an extradition request, as opposed to, she'd been in, I think, France. You can correct me, Mike. She'd been in France earlier.
She'd been to a whole string of countries in that sort of intervening period. And yeah, as Sven is explaining, she could have been picked up elsewhere. I think for the Americans, I think they realized they had an ironclad agreement with Canada. We're a security partner, we're a neighbor, and they could count on us to honor the treaty, which is what a lot of people argued we should have done, despite the fact it had horrible ramifications for these two people. Other ex-politicians like John Manley, a former foreign minister, has argued we should have botched the job strategically and let her get away to
let her go on to Mexico, which is where she was headed to do.
Yeah. And just basically, you know, sidestep it. And then this wouldn't have happened to Canada. We wouldn't receive this blowback. But that became sort of the central issue political issue that aside from the human suffering that kind of was played out through all of this is, do we break our rules? Do we bend our rules to avoid a conflict with China? We interviewed Brian Mulrooney in the book, and he said, you know what? It's terrible what happened to these guys, but, we have to honor our treaties with our best friends, the United States. Otherwise, what good is our word? So there was no, you know, there really wasn't room to screw up the arrest and let her get away, let's say.
I mean, one of the interesting questions is, you know, was Global Affairs Canada in the loop when the arrest was made? Because the view of some of the former very senior officials in that department who we talked to was that they would have smelled a rat a mile away here in this case, and would have strongly urged that, Canada, not get involved in this. As Mike just said, the view of many was, botch it, say, you know, the message arrived late, she's already on the plane to Mexico. So I think, you know, one of the interesting questions, and it's an unanswered question, is who actually knew what when this arrest took place, and was, you know, PMO and the Prime Minister himself aware of this and the consequences that would clearly come from it when they detained her in Vancouver Airport, and we won't see those files for a while yet.
What we do know right now, though, is that the RCMP knew, intelligence services knew, their American counterparts knew, the Canadian border services were really aware. They came up to speed really quick on who this person was and how important she was and who her father was, the founder of this company. Tech royalty in China, basically business royalty. But it raises the question that, I think we did find out later, and it was made public, probably at a press conference, that the Prime Minister's office did in fact know or was tipped off. But as we've seen time and time again, and just lately with all kinds of other events, is, the whiff of a political leader giving advice to a law enforcement agency and how to do their job. We know that doesn't go bad. That doesn't play well either. So,
exactly. No.
So it's whatever does happen, if that happens, then you can make the argument that totally plays into the intent of the Chinese to disrupt our democracy. Okay. Look, they can say, look, they broke their own rules. They played fast and loose and all of that. It was a paradigm.
One of the claims from China, as the Trudeau government was defending arresting Menwazo was that, you guys don't always follow the rule of law, because this happened just before SNC-Lavalin broke wide open. And they kept throwing SNC in the face of the Canadian government, saying, well, you follow the rule of law when it suits you, but right. you didn't in this case.
Well, I think, the other dimension to this is, you know, was there White House intervention with the Justice Department in going after Meng Wanzhou? Because if you look at other, you know, violations of U.S. sanctions cases, which was, you know, the basis for the arrest, and, the accusation against Meng Wanzhou was that she had lied in a presentation she gave to the Hong Kong Shanghai Banking Corporation about Huawei's relationship with its Iran-based subsidiary, Skycom. It was all pretty tenuous, actually. The offending slide was one slide didn't have that information on it. But the real issue is, why did they go after her and not the company? Because normally you go after the company, you negotiate then deferred prosecution agreement, et cetera, et cetera. And my suspicion is that, the Trump administration had no compunction about interfering with the work of the Justice Department. And, you know, this may well have been a case where officials in the White House on the National Security Council said, you know, let's go after Meng herself, not just the company.
I want to ask you about Trump in a moment, but I think it was you, Fenn, and so I'll start with you, that you mentioned, one of you mentioned John Manley earlier, and Manley did make those comments. Oh, you know, could have just botched it and let her get on the plane. But there were others that jumped out and immediately said, we should cut a deal with China. Yeah. Many of them, prominent Canadians, conservatives and liberals, former ministers, former prime minister, Jean Chrétien, I believe was one of them. Were you surprised at how many prominent Canadians were willing to step up and say, yeah, forget about our treaty with our American friends, just cut a deal, let her go?
So there are two dimensions there. One is, you know, the sort of views of Manley, Chrétien, others, who had extensive, certainly in the Chrétien era. I mean, that was the era of trade missions, Team Canada missions to China. The corporate sector did not want to see a disruption in relations with China. They wanted to expand business opportunities in China. So, you know, I wasn't surprised at the views of those who said, let's cut a deal. There was a letter that was sent to the Prime Minister's office, and full disclosure, I signed that letter, and that was in 2020. And that was really motivated by two things. One was COVID had struck, people were dying. There was real concern that these two guys were, at great risk. And this is before we had vaccines, we're talking 2020. In the full throes of COVID. Secondly, those who looked carefully, including some of Canada's most distinguished extradition experts, who said, the rule of law here, there's sort of a fork in the road here, and given the highly political nature of this case, there's nothing to stop Canada from cutting a deal with the Chinese. Part of the motivation here, and also recognition that the Trump administration was cutting deals, to be honest, left, right, and center, to get Americans out of Iranian jails, out of Syrian jails, out of all sorts of other places where they'd run into trouble. And so, you know, the sense was, you know, given the personal risk these two guys were at, you know, they were now, you know, they'd also been formally charged. Schellenberg, who was a Canadian, correct me, Michael, but he was a Canadian who'd been detained in China and was executed. So I think there was
no, he wasn't. He was convicted of drug dealing, drug trafficking. Yeah. He got a life sentence.
A life sentence,
exactly. and then the life sentence was increased to a death sentence, but he was never actually executed. But it was all part of the pressure play, along with saying, you know.
So there was real concern there that, you know, their lives were at risk, and you know, Canadian governments in the past had cut deals with very unsavory characters. When Bob Fowler, a very mm-hmm. official, was kidnapped by Al Qaeda in the Maghreb, you know, we actually paid some serious money there to release him. So negotiating hostage treaty, negotiating to, you know, to get hostages released is well established practice, including by the government of Canada.
Yeah, an unsavory business, but one that does happen. We need to take a quick break, and when we come back, I do want to ask you about Trump's double dealing and issues like that, and also comparisons to how Michael Kovrig, Michael Spavor were treated compared to Menwazo living it up in, what was it, West Vancouver? We'll talk about that when we come back.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Was Donald Trump trying to do a double deal when it came to the two Michaels? That's something that is put forward in the new book, The Two Michaels, by Mike Blanchfield and Fenn Osler-Hampson. And so, Mike, I guess I'll start with you and then hear from Fenn. Obviously, Trump was someone who, you know, I don't have that page open, but you quote him right in the book about, yeah, we'll talk about that. We'll cut a deal. He was freely talking about cutting deals. And in the end, it was an American deal that got them out. But was he playing a game with the lives of two Canadians?
He clearly saw a link between people in prison and how to cut a trade deal. And this was sort of a bombshell he dropped during an interview with the Reuters news agency early on, that, you know, he wasn't above doing this. And I was in the White House. I was in the Oval Office when he met Justin Trudeau in 2019. A year later, and it was one of those classic Trump photo ops, which turned into a 20-minute press conference, which most of it was Canadian reporters shouting at Trump and of him taking the bait and answering, what are you going to help these guys? What are you going to do? And the press conference ended with him basically suggesting, hinting, more or less saying, yeah, I'll be talking to Xi Jinping at the G20 summit next month, and I'll see what I can do. Sort of a typical kind of Trump, like, I'll talk about your deal there. And it was never really clear what he did, if anything. And it just seemed like they were sort of collateral damage in terms of his, you know, ongoing trade wars with China and trying to gain competitive advantage, you know, for American business and manufacturers. I mean, but when you fast forward to sort of after he's out of power and Biden is in power, I mean, it took the Biden administration about 9 months to review the case. They Joe Biden did an appearance with Trudeau in Ottawa virtually, their first summit during COVID, right after he was inaugurated in early 2021, and signaled that he didn't like this. He was going to take a look at it. And again, what got them out of Dodge, literally, was a deal, but it had to be brokered by the Americans. And it was Biden himself using leverage and capital with Xi Jinping directly to basically make the argument that you need to get rid of this irritant. And again, Biden didn't want to be seen to be messing with his Justice Department and how it was investigating things. So Dominic Barton, the Canadian ambassador to China, who's a former captain of industry, got involved. They went to the United States. They helped educate the Huawei people about, hey, maybe you could make a deal here and take some kind of business penalty and the case could be reconfigured and everyone saves face. And what it was an elaborate dance to engineer a prisoner swap with everyone trying to save face. And that included the Canadians saying, well, you know what? We followed the rule of law. We didn't cave. We didn't, get the minister to intervene under a special clause in our extradition law that the Chinese knew full well existed because they did their homework. So when we saw the chain of events play out, it was American prosecutors go to court and somewhere in greater New York City, they withdraw the charges provisionally, reinstate, this sort of DPA style prosecution against the company. And then Canada, the Canadian prosecutors, the Canadian prosecutors on behalf of the Americans making the extradition request stand up in a Vancouver courtroom a few hours later, and they're dropping the case. Everybody goes free. There's a jet with its engines warming on the tarmac of a private hangar in Vancouver, and off goes Meng. And meanwhile, behind the scenes, the two Michaels are rustled out of their cells. They're brought together, and they're put on an aircraft. And literally, it ended with a deal. And to pivot it back to Trump, Trump didn't make the deal. He didn't seem willing to make a deal. He, Trump the deal maker. Well, there was no deal to be had with Canada. We know he's, at the very least, he's, put it mildly, he's transactional. And looking back on it today, there was really nothing in it for him. Why should I do a favor for my friend or ally? Well, in the end, it was Biden who did that. And then we saw sort of it come full circle just recently when there is Biden back in Parliament. It's a real visit. It's not virtual. And suddenly there are the two Michaels. And it was, Biden was the guy who basically put the elbow grease into this to get it done in the end, to help out Canada, to do us a favor, deal for us.
Yeah, no, I think it wasn't just to help Canada. It's pretty clear that, because Xi Jinping had been embarrassed on the world stage with the arrest, the Chinese made it very clear to the Americans this issue had to be resolved if the Biden administration was going to turn the page, the Trump page, on relations with China. I know that sounds funny to be talking about or odd to be talking about that now, but Biden made it clear he wanted to have a much more working professional relationship with the Chinese. Of course, that hasn't happened, but he wanted to recalibrate it. This issue had to be resolved from a Chinese standpoint as well. The second point I would make there is that remember that the Chinese were going to be hosting the Winter Olympics at the end of 2021, which had been delayed because of COVID. This case was kind of hanging like an albatross. I mean, it had gathered enormous international attention. Partly through, or largely because of the efforts of our own government to, bring it to the attention of our allies and others, saying, this can happen to your people too. The issue really had to be dealt with, it came up in negotiations that Deputy Secretary Sherman had with the Chinese at the end of July 21, It was the subject of a phone call between the White House, President Biden, Xi Jinping in September. I mean, Mike's absolutely right that Biden, wanted to do something for Trudeau here, but it was also in the American interests to resolve the case.
I think you want to do something for Canada. I mean, look at the situation of the Americans right now. I mean, the world is fracturing all around them, right? You've got China and Russia, circling the wagons on Ukraine. You've got major parts of the of the world who are not on side with Canada and its NATO allies and some Asian allies against Russia. The Americans don't have the power base they once had. And it's been made very clear to me in conversations I've had with senior Americans that actually as little as we are and how insignificant we see each other, like every bit of help helps. If we send a few extra tanks or, buckets of ammunition to Ukraine, the Americans appreciate that because we're part of a team that is on their side helping. And it also, and Biden has said this repeatedly, it bears repeat. I think it's important in this context. The Americans are just relieved that they've got us on their border because they've got Mexico on the other border with a whole host of immigration and political issues to deal with there. And immigration, it's a gateway from, mass migration through, the Western Hemisphere and Latin America into the United States and sometimes up into Canada. So it's a very legitimate feeling that the Americans have these days that, yes, they always take us for granted and, we're barely acknowledged in Washington. We matter more now than we ever did because we're part of a dwindling group of countries that really is in their power sphere. And as we know, everything is so fractured, uncertain right now with this new war. And we see a new American detainee, with the Wall Street Journal right now in Moscow as well. So it's all about interest. As Fenn points out, yeah, the Chinese had a great interest in getting this irritant out of the way. They were going to host the world at the Olympics. It was all about saving face and putting on a good show. So, after a certain point, yes, Xi Jinping was disrespected, when this all happened and his minions ran around figuring out a way to do something. But in the end, it became an irritant. And I'm sure the thought in Beijing, they came around to the argument. They came around to the point of view. They had to be persuaded heavily that this is just a great big pain and an irritant. We got to figure out a way to get rid of these, get these guys out of here and hopefully never hear from them again.
Before I ask about going forward and, the efforts by the Canadian government on extrajudicial rendition and such, can either of you settle for me this idea? Start with you, Fenn, and then from Mike. Did the Trudeau government play a big role in brokering this release, or was it all the Americans? I've heard from folks in Ottawa, oh no, very much a big role. Heard from people in Washington, no role at all. It was a decision to move forward with deferred prosecution. Is either one true, or is it a case of the truth is somewhere in the middle?
Well, we did talk both on the record and off the record with senior officials in the administration. And it's clear that our ambassador to Washington, Ambassador
Hillman.
Hillman played a really important role in keeping the issue alive. There were a number of high-level meetings with White House officials that involved Ambassador Hillman and also Dominique Barton. So getting it on the radar, particularly with the new administration, was important. The second point I would make is that, even though he's come in for a lot of criticism, in many ways, the unsung hero in this story is Dominique Barton. And he played an important role, and Mike touched on this, but I think, we might want to underline it. in really helping the Chinese, helping Huawei, which was not getting, by the way, the best legal advice and team in the United States, because nobody wanted to touch them with a 10-foot pole, you know, given the troubles that they had run into with successive administrations in Washington, in helping them understand the game, the legal game of deferred prosecution agreements, and that you know, this was sort of standard practice. You know, you admit your culpability in an annex to an agreement, you know, which is kind of, you know, ultimately what happened there. But really sort of, you know, pushing them along to say, you know, there is a deal to be made here. And once you had a new sort of team in the Justice Department, with the Biden administration that, you know, was looking at this case, you know, deferred prosecution discussions had taken place under Trump, but went nowhere, as Mike mentioned. But, you know, they got traction under Biden because, you know, once, you know, his officials started looking at the case here, they, you know, they kind of came to the conclusion we might actually lose this one in court. So I think, you know, there was a greater appetite to come to an agreement here. But you know, we you know, our diplomats did play an important role. I think, and Mike can talk about this because, you know, he was tracking Philippe Champagne. But the agreement or declaration on arbitrary detention, which Canadian officials got a whole bunch of countries to sign up to, really, you know, put the Chinese in the spotlight on this one.
And so maybe, Mike, I can jump in and just do a slight redirect on that, because with China, that sort of thing can work. And there was an attempt to have an international conference last week. It's since been put off. But I don't see that embarrassing someone like Putin when we're dealing with Evan Gershkovich of the Wall Street Journal. So was that a successful play by Canada and our allies in saying we're against this extrajudicial detention? Will it have limited appeal?
Yeah, well, I think the way it works is you start with an aspiration and you get a bunch of people to agree on an idea. So, you know, to use another example, a long time ago, eventually people came around to the idea that smoking is bad for you, and you shouldn't smoke. You'll probably die and it'll kill you. Then a secondhand smoke will kill people around you. And then eventually regulation and binding, you know, mechanisms came into place, and now we have warning labels and fewer people smoke. And it was that way with landmines. Don't use landmines. They're really miserable weapons and you blow up innocent kids and look at the horrible pictures, you know? So I think it's starting that way with this. You don't take innocent people, hostages from another country for a political gain and lock them up as hostages to negotiate, which is what we're seeing with the Wall Street Journal, you know, reporter who, Brian, frankly, is a member of our tribe, right? You know, I'm sure I don't like seeing that any more than you do, right?
No.
So, but here we go again. But I think what the process of doing that, and to talk about François-Philippe Champagne for a moment, because I covered him while he was doing it and spoke to him about it in quite a bit of detail. I mean, he was basically hell-bent on doing whatever he could to embarrass the Chinese, and not embarrass the Chinese, but pressure them, but to bring other players to the table. And I think it was useful for Biden and the Americans and the Justice Department when they could look and say, okay, well, Canada's got, you know, eventually it was 70 countries saying this is bad. This is, you know, smoking is bad for you. It kills you. This is really bad behavior. You don't take other people, citizens hostage to win political battles. It gave an impetus, like a moral impetus to the Americans who were the practical, you know, they had to execute this practically. They had to decide it was their case. They had to decide how they were going to reconfigure it and do the deal that they did by, you know, withdrawing the charge specifically against the person, focusing on the company. They had a lot of Canadian help, And I think the Canadians did everything that they could have done politically, at the diplomatic level, at the political level. They built this coalition that may or may not, you know, make, I don't know what kind of difference it might make with Russia and this, and this, and
I mean,
so we'll see. So we'll see what happens. But I think it really, I mean, it was the assist, you know. I mean, they put the ball in play and the Americans scored the touchdown. I mean, I hate to dumb it down that way, but I think that's basically how it all came to pass.
Yeah, and China's not Russia. I mean, China, does a huge amount of business with the rest of the world. There were lots of people doing business in China who, you know, we're coming to the conclusion, gee, this could happen to us. Russia has very limited economic ties with certainly the Western world. And so that gives fewer points of leverage, to come back to your question. For the Chinese, saving face is very important part of or maintaining face, keeping face is an important part of their culture. I don't think Putin gives two figs about how he's viewed internationally. So,
I really don't either. Gents, so many more questions, most of which are answered in the book, but it's been a fantastic discussion today. So I want to thank you for your time and encourage everyone to pick up The Two Michaels by Mike Blanchfield, Fenn Osler Hampson. It's by Sutherland House Books. You can find it anywhere books are sold. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian.
Thanks, Brian. Right.
Full Comment is a Postmedia podcast. My name's Brian Lilly, your host. This episode was produced by Andre Prue. Theme music by Bryce Hall. Kevin Libin is the executive producer. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, etc. Give us a rating, leave a review, tell your friends about us, and thanks for listening.